Receive this episode and all others. Check out the show notes for the 5-Day Journaling Companion and follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you. When you feel the urge to take something personally, make an assumption or blame yourself automatically, pause and ask, is this truly mine to carry? Replace just one old belief with something kinder and more accurate. You don't have to rewrite your entire story overnight, just loosen one thread. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on. All you needed was some wind beneath your wings. We might be seeing things from different points of view, but that don't mean a thing. You and I, we were meant to be. I was made for you, you were made for me. So let it happen naturally. Things will work out fine, just you wait and see. Star out, but it was shining bright. So I held you in my arms with all my might. It felt good to be in love again. I didn't want that night to end. But all I needed was a little motivation. All you needed was a light to guide the way. We might disagree until we drive each other crazy. Things should be okay.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland, community radio for the Northwest. It's now time for Doug Holm and Film at 11.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, Jeff Godsell joins us to reflect on Clint Eastwood's film from 1992, Unforgiven. And Matthew will be joining us to review a DVD set from Criterion featuring the early films of Akira Kurosawa. But first, Rita Gordon discusses the recent Trinquet Lacan.
I found Trinquet Lacan on a British Film Institute Best of list from 2022, one of many films they recommend that skitter off the beaten studio track. This one ventures into the vast cattle and horse ranching grasslands of the Argentine Pampas. One of the pleasures of this film is its specificity and realness of place. You don't have the sense that the filmmaker distorted geography, enhanced the natural beauty, or hid any realities. On the contrary, it seems to be a kind of wry homage to a scrubby landscape that boasts problematic undergrowth, mud, and flowers that have more armature than eye appeal. And yet, it's a place you want to be. The director is Laura Citarella, one of the founders of El Pampero Cine, an Argentine film production collective of directors who are influential in Argentine cinema and are part of what's been called the new Argentine cinema movement, which has been described by one critic as, quote, inviting you into landscapes previously uncharted, from the province of Buenos Aires and beyond, reflecting a profound love for the labor of filmmaking while continually pushing boundaries and presenting the unexpected. Trenquilaucan is a real town in Argentina and where much of the film takes place, but the name seems almost to take on the character of a kind of reverential inside joke. Trenquilaucan is referenced constantly by the characters, and numerous signs and markers display the name throughout this film, so they become the pole around which the story weaves itself. Does the town really have a feminist radio station? Did a quasi-human creature truly emerge once from the local lagoon? Who knows? For this director, the town is a place to get lost in a story of Trenquilaucan. As I watched the film, one of Elizabeth Bishop's great poems, One Art, came to mind. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Loss, disappearance, the intent to be lost, the intent to be found, and whether it's all a disaster or not, these are the concerns of Trenquilaucan, which begins with two men searching for someone who turns out to be the main character and who has abruptly disappeared from their lives. Ezequiel, a stocky, quiet character who looks like he's just rolled out of bed, has been pressed into service to drive the energetic Rafa around the flat environs of the town. They're searching for Laura, Rafa's girlfriend, who is also his colleague at a distant university and a biologist in training, and who has apparently come to this place to research plant life. Although Ezequiel and Rafa have a few leads, they don't make much headway, and it doesn't take long for Ezequiel, who harbors a secret regarding Laura's disappearance and who is clearly chafing under Rafa's bossy directives, to ditch the boyfriend and take off on his own pursuit. Except that here the film begins to break apart into literally parts, each part told from the perspective of one of the characters. In this way, Citarella avoids the tired trope of a flashback and can begin to construct a much more complicated mosaic revolving around the beautiful, determined Laura, who has more than a streak of mysticism, an abundance of curiosity, and a willingness to drive off the main route. Laura's character, played by the luminous Laura Paredes, is apparently the continuation of a character from Citarella's previous film, Ostende. Although Laura has come to Trenquilaucan to study plant life, she quickly confesses to Ezequiel, who has been hired to drive her to various locations, that she's been pulled in a few different directions, offering more enthralling pursuits. The first is a discovery of letters tucked between stuck pages and books in the town's library. Laura's unearthed some kind of love story that plays out in these found letters, and her growing passion for solving the mystery catches up Ezequiel as well, who, when he can take time off from caring for his three children, indulges her increasing focus on tracking down the elusive personas of this intriguing romance. When all of this begins to feel like an extended red herring, Citarelli unfortunately makes it longer, with some scenes involving Ezequiel moonily playing the longing lover in the story that Laura has pierced together as her voiceover describes their relationship.
Creo que me volví la única testigo de un pequeño misterio.
Opa.
Sí.
Estoy buscando una amiga que está con la clasificación de plantas, flores y...
When all of this begins to feel like an extended red herring, Citarelli unfortunately makes it longer, with some scenes involving Ezequiel moonily playing the longing lover in the story that Laura has pierced together as her voiceover describes their relationship. But like many things in this film, then the story just disappears. Because another is taking shape from another story seed that has already been planted out in the field. Laura has met a mysterious woman who demands to know whether she's found a particular yellow flower. While this brusque stranger doesn't reappear for a while, Laura's curiosity has been at work. She's kind of like a film director who's always working on the next project. The stranger reappears when another odd story surfaces, that of a creature found in the lagoon that gives Trenquilaucan its name. Rumors and news reports go wild over this creature, who is examined by a scientist, who, Laura realizes, is the very same woman who asked about the flower. One realization leads to another, and suddenly Laura is tracking her down to a farm she inhabits with her female partner. The couple invite Laura to stay with them, and she does so, hoping to get a glimpse of the creature who may be hidden somewhere in the house. One of the most enjoyable aspects of this film is the exposition via a feminist radio talk show, hosted by an ironic, acerbic, but also compassionate radio producer named Juli, played by Juliana Moras, possibly the most fascinating figure in the whole film. Juli runs the radio show, mocking her male colleagues on air, giving Laura a berth on her show while needling her for not yet having her degree, and allowing Ezequiel to listen while she watches him and listens herself to Laura's recorded voice telling Juli about her increasingly peculiar life. Juli's face, as she reacts to her radio colleagues, to Laura's stories, to Ezequiel's expressions as he listens, exemplify what, for me, film does in a way no other art can. Bear witness. Allow us to watch the ineffable dynamic of human interaction. Put another way, instead of offering a critique of the male gaze, this film makes a strong case for the equally disturbing effects of the female gaze, especially when females are gazing at each other. In fact, the film's strongest elements are all the intriguingly ambiguous and yet charged interactions between the characters, often without words. Between Laura and Ezequiel, falling a bit in love, as she puts it. Between Laura and Juli, who sometimes seem equal, sometimes not. Between Laura and the lesbian couple with their never-revealed secret, who treat her with a kind of fond taunting, yet also depend on her for help. Nothing, no relationship, no story is resolved in this film. Facts and stories are left crackling in the air in the wake of their interactions. Laura herself waxes and wanes as a forceful presence in contrast to the women around her. With Ezequiel, she is a bit peremptory, passionate, focused. With Juli, she looks smaller, less sure of herself. And up against the enigmatic couple, she can seem downright foolish, if still eminently lovable. As noted, disappearances proliferate in this film. The main character makes a disappearance at the beginning of the film, and by the end we'll have seen disappear, not always for good, not always chronologically, her reason for being in Trenkelauken, the story she has become obsessed with, all of her possessions, her boyfriend, even the unseen entity that has become an urban folktale in Trenkelauken that can't be compelled to make an appearance. Oh, and Ezequiel's car. The film is long, a bit over 4 hours, and begins to feel a bit more like a series than a film. As a producer, Citarella oversaw a 14-and-a-half-hour film called La Flor, which has been called, quote, overflowing with nested subplots and whiplash digressions, and directed the film Ostende, also about the character Laura, who is also being drawn into other people's stories. I have a feeling that once she becomes better known in this country, her flair for odd relationships, digressions, and her emphasis on mystery, pulling people from their ordinary lives, will make her, if not famous, at least a filmmaker we won't want to lose.
Thanks, Rudo. And you are listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. Now, here is Jeff on Unforgiven.
Looking back at 1992, I watched Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven for the first time. I was curious to see whether it really deserved all the accolades that it received at the time. Had it been a weak year that year? Was Eastwood just getting recognition for being in the business that long? It turned out that it really is that good, and that's saying something coming from someone who really isn't that keen on the Western as a genre. The Academy has often been kind to actor-directors. There was Robert Redford for Ordinary People, Mel Gibson with Braveheart, Kevin Costner with Dances with Wolves. So on the face of it, it wasn't a shocker to see Oscars go to the film and its director, but was this any different than any of the other 15 or so Westerns that Eastwood had appeared in or directed? Well, yes and no. By 1992, Eastwood had a company of craftsmen at his production company, Malpasso, some of whom could be traced back to his days on Rawhide. Suffice to say that there was a camaraderie on the set and a workmanlike absence of tension. But a good shoot does not necessarily a good film make. In fact, it's most often the opposite. Many of the same elements that go into all of Eastwood's films are present here. A certain confidence in the pacing, a sense of humor, attention given to the importance of minor characters. In fact, Eastwood said that he wanted to have everything he ever wanted in a Western to be included in this one.
Step over to the office and get the bullwhip.
A whipping? That's all they get after what they've done?
Get out of there!
It was a matter of honor.
They're paying $1,000 to whatever kills the two boys that cut up Delilah.
In a time when lawmen were killers.
What are y'all looking at?
You English, Bob?
Outlaws were heroes.
Well, I thought that you were dead.
Hell, I even thought I was dead. Till I found out it was just in Nebraska.
And a bad reputation.
You're the one who killed William Harvey and robbed that train over Missouri?
Was as good as gold.
My guess is you're calling yourself Mr. William Money.
Say what?
You don't look no meaner than hell, cold-blooded damn killer.
I ain't like that anymore, kid.
$1,000 reward, Will. Nobody's gonna come.
So you still have that Spencer rifle, huh?
Yeah.
He's my partner. If he don't go, I don't go.
What's it come to, 3 ways?
Just because we're going on this killing, that don't mean I'm gonna go back to being the way I was.
Are you really gonna kill them, cowboy?
I do not like assassins. Or men of low character.
We ain't bad men no more. We're farmers.
They're a lot of savages! A bunch of bloody savages! Assassins!
Well, I guess they have it coming.
We all have it coming, kid.
Some legends will never be forgotten. Some wrongs can never be forgiven.
Any man don't want to get killed. Better clear on out the back.
Unforgiven.
Everything does come together in Unforgiven to support a script that provides surprising gravitas to its simple story. In some ways, it's Eastwood's Annie Hall, made in much the same way with the same themes and as his other films, but for one time, the end product is greater than the sum of its parts. The screenplay for what would become Unforgiven was by David Webb Peoples. It had been floating around Hollywood for a while, and it was read by one of Eastwood's longtime script readers. She hated it and strongly discouraged Eastwood from even bothering. But later, while working on a completely separate project, a producer recommended a screenwriter to work on that, and that screenwriter was David Webb Peoples. And he gave Eastwood that same screenplay as an example of his work. Eastwood read it and loved it and wanted to shoot it. But he felt he was a bit too young still for the lead. So he hung on to it until almost a decade later. One thing he liked about it was how the attention is originally on the character of the sheriff, leading you to think that he will be the protagonist. Ah, but things are about to shift. Unforgiven opens in the small town of Big Whiskey, Wyoming. Not much of a town, but big enough to have a saloon and a whorehouse. One night, a drunken cowboy slashes a prostitute's face with a knife. The sheriff in Big Whiskey is Little Bill Daggett, played by Gene Hackman. Daggett makes you surrender your guns when you enter town, but he's no pacifist. His tight grasp on the scales of justice can include lashes from his whip. He surprises some of the townspeople, not to mention the whores, by sparing the cowboy the whip and demanding instead that he give up to Daggett some of the ponies that he and his partner are wrangling before they get out of town. They accept, and out of guilt and in a rare act of kindness, the partner offers one of the ponies to the whore. What am I going to do with a pony, she says. Outraged at the lack of justice, the whores all get together, pool their savings, and come up with $1,000 bounty to find the two cowboys and kill them. The word gets out. One day, a poor widowed pig farmer in Kansas named Will Money, Clint Eastwood, is approached on horseback by a young man who calls himself the Schofield Kid. He says he's an experienced bounty hunter and tells Will about the $1,000 price on the cowboys. You see, the kid knows about Will's past as a notorious outlaw and killer, and he could use his help on collecting the bounty. Will explains that his killing days are over and that he's disgusted by them. And as a tribute to the memory of his dead wife, he declines. But there's no mistaking that he and his kids are struggling and near starving. The promise of what $500 could do for his family changes his mind. Much to the initial chagrin of the kid, Will also enlists the aid of his longtime friend, Ned Logan, another retired outlaw, played by Morgan Freeman. The kid insists that he still get half the bounty until it's discovered that he's severely nearsighted and can't shoot anything that isn't right in front of him. He agrees to go thirds, realizing that he needs all the help he can get. The dialogue in Unforgiven is simple to the point and believable, and laced with just the right amount of frontier humor. As the trio trudge along the plains in pursuit of their bounty, you can smell the clean air and feel the rain. Last time I felt that way about a Western was with Shane. Unforgiven was shot in Alberta, Canada, by longtime Eastwood collaborator Jack N. Green, and the entire town of Big Whiskey was constructed there. Eventually, the trio succeed in tracking down their bounty, and the partner is killed. One down. It's Will who has to do the shooting, as Ned falters. Ned decides he wants to quit, and he heads back home. Meanwhile, Sheriff Daggett doesn't take kindly to anyone overriding his sense of justice. And when Ned is captured by deputies and brought back to Big Whiskey, Ned is whipped in the hopes of finding the other two's whereabouts. Will and the kid catch up to the cowboys at their ranch, and Will directs the kid to ambush the second cowboy while he's sitting in the outhouse. Later, after making their escape, kid distraughtly confesses that he'd never killed anyone in his life. When a prostitute arrives with the reward, she also brings the news that not only has Ned been captured, but he's died from the sheriff's beating. That night, Willow returns to a rain-drenched town to find Ned's body propped up in an open casket outside the saloon with a mocking sign attached saying, "This is what we do to assassins in Big Whiskey." In the memorable conclusion, which I won't spoil here, Will gets his revenge on Sheriff Daggett for the killing of his friend. While there is much gunplay in Unforgiven, the film nevertheless delivers a powerful message that violence damages the soul of anyone who is touched by it. In fact, Gene Hackman had originally turned down the role of Little Bill Daggett, not wanting to make any more violent films, until he realized that that theme was being conveyed. And that is also, I think, what elevates Unforgiven, as well as an unusually pro-woman stance, above most other Westerns. In addition to winning Oscars and BAFTAs and awards around the world, Unforgiven was even remade in Japan. It was also selected in 2008 by the American Film Institute as the fourth greatest American Western of all time, behind The Searchers, High Noon, and Shane. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And be sure to visit Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. Up next is Matthew to tell us about a recent re-release of this DVD collection from Criterion's Eclipse series of the first films of Akira Kurosawa.
Akira Kurosawa had been a sort of a lifelong film fan by the time he went to work for what would become Toho Studios in 1938. 4 years later, he would be a screenwriter for the company, and he would adapt a novel called Sanjiro Sagata by Tenio Tomita. And to his surprise, he was given the assignment to direct the film. So this became his very first movie in 1942 that he would produce. You could call this set of films Akira Kurosawa, The War Years, because it was under the studio system, which was, of course, controlled by the Japanese government at that time. This film, since it was set in the Meiji period, the end of the 19th century, the studio kind of let Kurosawa go ahead and make the movie without a lot of propagandistic jingoism in it. And so this movie is about a judo wrestler, here played by the wonderful Tsushima Fujita, who would be Kurosawa's sort of leading man through most of the decade. Also in the cast is Takashi Shimura, who would be later appear in Akira. He would be the leader of the Seven Samurai. For another director, he would appear in the Godzilla movies as the professor who helps fight the giant monster. But that was 10 years later. Here in the early 40s, we have this story about a young wrestler who sort of wrestles with his inner self as well as his outer self. And there's a rivalry between the judo wrestlers and the jiu-jitsu wrestlers. And that's sort of the background of this film, where we get this rivalry with this other rival jiu-jitsu fighter, and some very interesting cinematography. I think this film is really influenced a lot by the French romantic realism, because it's all very nicely set with interesting little vignettes about nature or the way nature comes in and affects the action. The climactic battle is really almost dreamlike, as it's set in this field of wheat or grain that's blowing around in this strong wind as the two men fight. Very interesting film, and it was very popular at the time. The popularity brought Kurosawa to the attention of the Navy Department, and they wanted him to do a propaganda movie. And that was his next film, which was called The Most Beautiful. This is set in an optics factory. And here we've got the women who live in a dormitory, and they form up each morning and they march into work singing patriotic songs as they play their fife and drum corps, and they get to work. But as the story progresses, it turns out the women are a little disgruntled about something. And it turns out that the men in the factory have been ordered to increase production 100%, whereas the women have only been ordered to 50%. And the gals feel that they could do a lot more for the emperor, and they should be given a chance to do 80%. And so they're allowed to do that. But in the course of increasing production, like, one girl gets sick and she wants to hide it because she doesn't want to stop working. The leader of the group, her mother is dying, but both parents tell her, no, you stay on the job. So it's like I said, it's a propaganda movie. The individual is submissive to the will of the society. And so she has to work at the factory. And there she is at the end, in spite of her mother dying, she's there working away. And one thing out of this movie, it's very in a documentary style. It's not very jingoistic. But it's more of a record of how people had to live under the Japanese regime at this time. Kurosawa would also meet his wife during the production. This was followed by another propaganda film, and this time a sequel to the first movie, Sanjuro Sagata, Part 2 is what it was called. Now this, whereas the other film was a lot like French poetic realism, this movie is a lot like German expressionism, with some scenes appearing like from a Fritz Lang movie, or maybe even Eisenstein or Joseph von Sternberg. Or Sugata is this famous wrestler, but he's kind of called in to defend Japanese martial arts against, you know, Western boxing, and then even these crazy new karate guys that show up. Giving the film sort of elements of the horror movie, foretelling the many instances of madness that would show up in Kurosawa's later movies, like Throne of Blood or the drug addict scenes in High and Low. So in spite of this also being a propaganda movie, promoting the superiority of the Japanese spirit over all others, that sort of thing. But again, it's still a very interesting film, with Kurosawa doing a lot of interesting, you know, expressionistic sort of compositions that he would use in later films. Now, this brings us to the last film, and that is The Men Who Tread on Tigers' Tails. Now, here Kurosawa had done two assignments for the studio, and here they let him go ahead and adapt this kabuki play. I think it was also a no play, but like a lot of, you know, things from history which become legends and then they become a good story. Here we have this lord who's trying to, and his retainers, they're trying to sneak through the border because his uncle has betrayed him and there's a price on his head and he's going to be executed. And so he and his warriors are going to sneak out disguised as monks. But it turns out that the lordship isn't quite up to the disguise, and so they have to rethink what they do. They could easily fight their way through the checkpoint, but no, then they would have to fight through another one and another one. So there's a sort of back and forth, kind of chess-like psychological game between the head retainer and the chief guard, here again played by Susumu Fujita. The reason I think this set is worth taking a look at is because how influential Kurosawa would be to movies today. Now, we just talked about a Clint Eastwood movie. Well, Kurosawa influenced Sergio Leone, who hired Clint Eastwood for his first big starring role. So here Kurosawa has an influence on Clint Eastwood, but he also had a big influence on George Lucas in his movie The Hidden Fortress. But this movie is very much like a Star Wars film with the opening title and the mission that had to be completed. These are the first four films of Akira Kurosawa from Criterion's Eclipse series, number 23.
Thanks, Matthew. And thank you for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification.